Welcome to the Buddhist Society, and tonight our guest is Venerable Ajahn Brahmalamso, normally called Ajahn Brahm. He's also a Mahathera. This year he was honored in Her Majesty's list, and he has become a member of the Order of Australia for his services to Buddhism and to gender equality, which is a really important thing. And our talk tonight here at the Society is Relax to the Max.
So the title of the talk, Relax to the Max. Now, one of the reasons I keep traveling around the world teaching is because there's one of my great friends as a monk who spent about 4 or 5 months in a monastery in Perth many years ago called Ajahn Gunha. And he's a very special monk. He was the monk who was in the forests, the jungles of Thailand, meditating with a number of other monks. And they opened their eyes after the meditation because they saw a snake coming towards them, a huge king cobra. This is a true story. Many monks saw this. The king cobra came up to him, raised its head, opened its hood. It wakes people up. And in that part of Thailand, the nickname for the king cobra was the one-step snake. The reason they gave it that nickname was because if you were unfortunate enough to be bitten by the king cobra, you'd have one more step and then you'd be dead. It was a very venomous snake. So there was this monk sitting in the jungle with a king cobra right in front of his nose. Relax a bit. So, what would you do if that happened to you? Would you get up and run away? Now, I lived 9 years in Thailand in that northeast part. I saw many huge snakes. And those snakes, not only could they swim in the lakes, they could climb trees, and also they could move so fast through the forest that it was amazing to see. There's no way, even in the forest, you'd be able to outrun a cobra. So what did this monk do? This monk lifted up his hand and patted the king cobra on the head. Thank you for visiting me. It's so nice you dropped by to say hello. Just like I always come to the Buddhist Society in Eccleston Square whenever I'm in London, I too drop by. But I'm not venomous, not like this cobra. Welcome, thank you for visiting me. And what did you think that cobra would do? There's no way that cobra would bite this monk. It's so rare you get your head patted as a snake. That cobra was enjoying every minute of being patted on its head. And after Ajahn Gunha patted it many times on the head, that's when the snake drew in its hood, put its head down, and slid over to the next monk to get his head patted. And that second monk said, no way, you go back, I'm not doing that. But that was one of the great monks of Thailand. So he was a good friend as well. And for anyone's interest, we also share in common, he also was expelled for Wat Phol for ordaining novice nuns in his monastery. But anyway, that's beside the point. That he was, I went to visit him 2 or 3 years ago. And in public with many other people listening, he said to me, Ajahn Brahm, you're now an international monk doing a great service. If you stop traveling and teaching, you'll die. That was a rotten thing to say. It meant I can't retire. I have to keep on visiting London and many other places. Otherwise, I've had it. So anyway, that's why I'm happy to teach. And it's also why when I go many places, I'm not quite sure what I talked about last year, but looking at the audience, there's many elderly people here, and I always hope that you've developed Alzheimer's or dementia in a little way. So even if I did say it last year, you won't remember. So I went with Ajahn Gunha to South Korea about 14 months ago, because we were doing a peace initiative close to the demilitarized zone, and doing some meditation, some talks. I was invited over there with 2 or 3 other monks, and it came the time that we wanted to do a peace walk inside the demilitarized zone. And all the other monks were not fit enough to do this 3-hour walk. It was about 13, 14 kilometers. So I volunteered to do this walk inside the demilitarized zone between the two Koreas. There was lots of shooting, as you'd expect in such a sensitive area. And I was shot many times. As a monk, I cannot lie. I was shot with cameras and videos. Because it's all recorded, put on TV. But one thing which I did notice, anyone from Korea here, South Korea? Korea's okay. They're very great Buddhists. But when I was there, that you could see that one of their problems in their economy, in their social structure, and even in their Buddhism, that they were very tense, very uptight. So when they asked me for some advice before I left after doing the walk through the DMZ, I taught them how to relax to the max. Because too many people try too hard and they're far too tense. And it has lots and lots and lots of problems in all parts of their life. For example, if I have my robe here and keep pulling it and stretching it, how long do you think this robe is going to last? When it's under tension, eventually it will break. One thing in our modern society, we don't know how to relax. Even when you have a day off, what do? Catch up on all of your business. Do you ever complete all those tasks which you're supposed to perform? Of course you don't, because we don't know how to relax to the max. So one good simile of that. There was a professor in the Department of Economics at a prestigious university somewhere in UK. God, it used to be. We're not ready. That's where Colin used to teach. And he came into the class with a big jar. And they didn't know what he was up to. And then from his bag, his briefcase, he took a bag of stones. And one by one, he put them into the jar. until he could get no more stones in the jar. And he said to this class, "Is the jar full?" He said, "Yes, can't get any more stones in." And he smiled, reached into his briefcase and brought out a bag of gravel, smaller stones, which could fit in the spaces between the big rocks. "Is the jar full now?" "No," as the class was onto him by now. So he got some fine sand out of his briefcase, poured it in, shook the jar until the sand filled all the spaces between the rocks and the gravel. "Is the jar full now?" And they said, "You probably figure out another way to put something else in there." He smiled, he took the water jug and poured water in it until the water filled up the spaces between the sand, the gravel and the rocks. When he'd finished, he asked his class, his economic class, "What do you think is the meaning of this demonstration?" To which the class said, "It means, sir, no matter how busy you are, you can always fit something more in." He said, "No. It means if you want to put the big rocks in, the precious stones, you have to put them in first." It was a message on priorities. What's really important in your life? Schedule that in first. Don't try and fit that in the end. Otherwise, you can't get the big rocks in. The small sand and the water, you can schedule those in afterwards, but not the big rocks. So what's important in your life? Yeah, family. Family is important. Your health is important. But also relaxation is important. We've lost the art of relaxation. So yes, of course you're busy, of course you've got lots of things to do, but in the great example of this other Thai monk, Buddhadasa, he was building his hall in his monastery, Suan Mok, in the south of Thailand. And when it came to the rainy season retreat, 3 months when we stopped doing work, when we relax to the max, he sent the builders home. Didn't want any noise, no sort of decisions during that time. So the builders went home, and a few days later, a visitor came. And the visitor, we've got a visitor now. Come in. Yeah, please, come in, I think. Oh, is it Halloween? Yeah, thank you for coming in. Hi.
Hi.
Very good, good to see you. And the visitor asked, "Is your hall finished? When's it going to be finished?" And the monk said, "The hall is finished." I mean, when are you going to complete building the hall? Well, I told you already, it's finished. What? Are you going to leave it like this? Are you going to leave it without a roof on, with no glass in the windows, with cement bags all over the floor? What do you mean, it's finished?" And the great monk said, "What's done is finished." He went off to meditate. That's the only way you can find some peace in life, to be able to have that idea of prioritizing peace and rest and relaxation, rather than finishing everything first. Otherwise, you will not finish all your jobs before you can take a rest. Finished rest before you do the job. It's called prioritizing. There was a nun, a bhikkhuni, who had a little vihara in Oxford. And one day, someone called her on the telephone, "Venerable, we need you to come and do a ceremony for us. And she replied, I'm sorry, I'm busy today, I can't come. Why? Said the caller. It's because I'm very busy. Yeah, but what are you doing? I'm doing nothing, said the wise bhikkhuni. And the caller said, ah, wonderful. That's what Buddhist monks and nuns, leaders should be doing. Teaching by example, showing the path and walking the path. So, well done. A Buddhist monk was a nun, prioritizing, relaxing, doing nothing. So, she carried on doing nothing all day, and then the following morning, she got a call again. The same caller. Our great issue, look, I really need you to come and do a ceremony in my house. She said, sorry, I can't come, I'm busy. You were busy yesterday. Yeah, I'm busy again today. What are you doing today? Same as yesterday, nothing. That was your excuse yesterday. Yes, said the wise bhikkhuni. I'm not finished yet. So get doing nothing out of the way first. And when you're finished doing nothing, then maybe do something. But we're so restless that we get sick. Is when I teach meditation retreats, the first day or two, people are always sleepy. In fact, many people copy my talks and listen to them before they go to bed, and it sends them to sleep. I still don't know if that's a compliment or a fault, but at least they have a good night's sleep. Oh, and I was in Berkeley in June, and there somebody came up on the stage to introduce me, and they say, Ajahn Brahm, I go to bed with him every night, and I wake up with him in the morning. I say, what? I'm innocent. I'm not a muck like that. They said, what I mean is that I listen to his talks. And when I wake up in the morning, you know, the plug is still in my ear hole, so I'm still sort of listening to him. But anyway, what it does mean is just we learn how to relax, we become far more healthy and efficient. We have got what is called sleep deficit. We don't sleep enough. We're worried, we're anxious, we don't know how to let go of all our burdens and concerns and just relax. Even just asking a person to say that, relax to the max. They don't even, they rush that saying. It's relax to the max. I'm a monk, I know how to say those words. So when we are doing things, we prioritize relaxation. And if you prioritize relaxation, all those other things which you think, oh, I haven't got time to do this, haven't got time to do that, of course you get time. Because when you're really relaxed, you're efficient. Your mind becomes clear. You can innovate. You can do more work in less time. And you don't create so many enemies when you say words you really shouldn't have said simply because you were too tired and too tense. So this is why relaxation can help solve many both relationship problems. The only reason why we argue. And someone once said, when we have a problem with a relationship, when you find you're shouting at people you live with and people you love, why? Why do you have to shout at each other? Shouting at each other is a sign that you are emotionally distant. Just like if someone's on the other side of the road, I have to shout at them so they can hear me, because they are physically distant. But the only reason why we shout when they're sitting right next to you, or just over the coffee table at home, is because they're emotionally distant. It's a sign that your relationship needs to come together a little bit more. But many times it's because we're just so tight and tense and tired. One more thing and it just really tips you over. It's called the lack of resilience, because of too much tiredness. I don't know how many of you play musical instruments. The musical instrument I used to play when I was young was a gramophone record. But many of you, I think, may be musicians. And if you play string instruments, you can imagine, say, like a violin string. If it's very tight, very taut, stretched at both ends, when something hits it, it makes a loud noise, a high-pitched noise. If you loosen the tension and you hit it, it makes a low noise, a low-pitched sound. If there's no tension in it at all, something hits it and it doesn't reverberate. That's the simile of resilience in our world. Sometimes we're so taut and so tight, little things happen to us. Somebody says a small thing and we blow up. A virus goes around and we just overreact to it in our body. Just like, I know Desmond kindly asked me, how's my health been? I did have a disease I went to Indonesia, a very bad cough for about 2 or 3 months. And I found out it was the pony virus. Has the pony virus come to the UK? You know it's a pony virus because it makes you a little horse. Pony virus, horse. Okay. But, you know, when you travel around a lot, you expect to get sick. You know, you go to all these airports, and you can expect to get terminal illness. Okay, just one more. And if you do pass away, you know the last part of your body which turns off when you die? The last part of your body, the last organ which switches off when you die. Many people think it's their heart or their brain. They're wrong. It's the eye. The pupil of the eye is the last thing which stops working. You know why? Because only the pupils dilate. That's true, they dilate. And one of the reasons I tell jokes is because it forces people to relax. Because once they start laughing, not thinking about all of the difficulties and problems in their life, they can relax. So physically, when we learn how to enjoy this moment and relax, we can become remarkably healthy. We can sleep well at night. So part of even the Buddhist meditation technique, you know, the kayagata sati, just being aware of your body and learning how to relax your body, is very powerful. So, you know, we learn, we've got a body here. My body is 68 years of age, and again, there's no way I can retire. I will die, according to Ajahn Gunha. In Australia, that means that they will never give me a pension. Although I did, this last year, I decided to apply for, this is a Commonwealth of Australia, seniors card. I can make it an old age card. I don't get any benefits from it, but I thought, well, why not? I can, so I will. There was a problem. Because I did everything on the computer, but they said no, because of the problem, worldwide problem of identity fraud, that I need to go to the office personally and prove my identity. So I went up to the office in town, made an appointment, waited, of course, until the appointment was due. I went up to the person and they asked me, can you please prove who you are? And I replied to her, for the last 45 years as a monk, I've been trying to find out who I am, or if I am. So actually, I don't know. And it was amazing, the person on the other side of the counter didn't think that was funny. They would now. I don't think there's a sense of humour in the government service. So anyway, they said, look, ID. What ID have you got? So I got a passport. So I showed them the passport. Okay, that's okay, we need more. So that's all I've got. So what about your driver's licence? I'm a monk, I don't drive. So what about your credit card? I don't have a credit card. Bank account, don't have one of those either. What about your rental agreement? I don't rent. What about your home ownership certificate? I don't own a home. I just live in a monastery in a cave. Got any proof of that? No. And honest truth, well, they asked me next, said, have you got a marriage certificate? Of course not. And they said, well, you don't exist. You know, according to all the things you need in like the government service, you don't exist. I said, wow, the Buddha was right. No self, I proved it, I don't exist. So it's some fun being a monk and messing around with people. Even, just almost similar, at Perth Airport. Not this trip, the previous trip. You know they ask you as you go through the customs, they check your baggage, and they ask you if you've got any liquids in your bag. I said, no. They said, no liquids at all, no hair gel. I said, come on. And they laughed as well. So anyway, so when you can relax, then you don't get upset. I found that more people relax, the more they can laugh at themselves and others. They're not so tight and tense. And so their resilience is totally different. They don't get upset or offended these days. So your body relaxes, even your facial muscles relax. Was it a year or two ago? I was over in Bangkok. I was invited to give a talk at an anti-aging conference, because a lot of people, they're really into deceit, trying to look younger than they really are. So I went up there and just, you know, how you can use maybe meditation, you know, so that you don't age so much. I think it was actually proven in the Shambhala project. It was very strict scientific controls that when you meditate, what is it, the telomeres, these little ends of your DNA, don't fray when they divide. In other words, you don't. It reduces your aging. And so when they asked me, Ajahn Brahm, entitled, how old are you? And I said 60. They said, no way, you look much younger than that. What's the secret of looking so young? And I replied, because I've never been married. Some of you laugh, you get in trouble when you go home. It's not that, it's having no worries, no concerns. Finding some joy and relaxation in life. Learning how to relax. So when you do body awareness, you can actually relax parts of your body. And a serious part of this is, as a Buddhist monk, sometimes living in remote places, there's no doctors. You don't have a mobile phone. So if you have any acute sicknesses or illnesses, you're in big trouble if you didn't have other ways of dealing with them. And this particular story, a few years ago, it's amazing what meditation can do. I had food poisoning. Not sort of just stomach ache, but real solid food poisoning where your stomach and everything cramps up and it's extremely painful. And I was in my cave, so when I was screaming, no one could hear me. So it was a long way to the hospital anyway. And I'm not sure why I had stomach cramps and food poisoning. But if you see how we eat, people bring us food to eat. And sometimes I don't know what they're bringing us. Sometimes they get it right, sometimes they don't get it right. And it's what we call in Buddhism, for monastic Buddhism, occupational hazard. But there, real food poisoning. I was in my cave. Ah! When I usually tell this story to you in the middle of a talk, because sometimes during the middle of the talk people start feeling a bit sleepy. Ah! And that soon wakes them up. And if kids are listening and they're getting bored, ah! That wakes them up. Whenever you give talks, you must always make it dramatic. Ah! Or, and then people remember it. So anyway, there I was, having stomach pains, really bad. There we go. And so what to do? So what I did, what I've been taught, and how I teach others, be mindful of that extraordinary pain in your tummy and just learn how to relax it. Relax to the max. And over many years, you've learned how to do that. You know how to lift your arm. You know how to move things in your body. To take that area, not be afraid, and just relax it as much as you can. And every time I relax that area of my body through my body awareness, and through kindness, the kindness is a way to relax things, then I found that feeling, that tightness, that pain, got a tiny bit less. Only a tiny bit, but I kept on going. Another tiny bit less, another tiny bit less. It took me about 20 minutes, maybe half an hour, I'm not quite sure. But after that time, there was no ache or pain or cramps in my tummy at all. The food poisoning had vanished. It was real food poisoning, not exaggerating. Somehow or other, I learned how to take a very dangerous acute symptoms and just relax them all away. Until there was no pain at all, it never came back. Amazing what meditation can do. And afterwards, I started to wonder, how does that work? Because that was apparently food poisoning's got real bacteria in your guts, maybe Salmonella or I don't know E. coli, but there's real bacteria there causing havoc in your digestive system. So how on earth did that work? But it certainly did work. And then I visualized what my theory was of how this works. I imagine these bacteria, the last time I looked through a microscope at bacteria, they were like blobs, little tentacles coming out of them. So I imagined that after I'd done this relaxation exercise to my own digestive system, that all those bacteria were there still in my digestive system, but now all their tentacles were crossed in full lotus, or put their hands, that they were all meditating peacefully. I don't know if that was the case, but certainly there was no more aches or pains left. And it wasn't suppressed, it gone for almost forever. And that's how I've used this relaxation technique on your own body many, many times. I do live a busy life. And sometimes you're about to give a talk, and many people have come to listen to you, and you've got the sniffles, cold or a flu about to come. If I need that time, you just look at that irritation in your nostrils. Feel it. Don't be afraid of it. And you learn how to relax. Really relax. Deeply relax. Until the sniffles, the sinus fluid stops running out of your nose. I remember doing that once, just half an hour before I was going on live TV in South Korea. I thought, oh my goodness, I can't explain. I didn't know enough South Korean language to be able to tell them that, please can I not go on, I've got a cold. I didn't have any medicines, so just meditated in my room. And so it just disappeared. Relaxing it deeply. So physical relaxation, it's not just means, doesn't just mean you don't get ill in the first place. It also means that if some bacteria or some overreaction in the body does happen, you can actually do something about it and really relax it. The health benefits of meditation, brilliant. And these are real cases where people suffer immensely. And to be able to overcome some of those sicknesses, or teach people how to overcome some of those sicknesses, is a wonderful thing to be able to do. And of course you do it on yourself. And of course, learning how to sleep well at night, and also learning how to have your relationships with others so you don't argue, you relax. So you don't feel that you have to respond in an aggressive way. Or when you're driving, sometimes, we're late for an appointment. Sometimes our driver doesn't arrive early enough, which means you don't get to meet your parents early enough, or you're about an hour late to meet your brother. What do people do when they're late? They rush. And you can't do anything. You can't make it faster. In fact, the faster you try and go, usually the more problems you have. So for me, if you are late for an appointment, you relax. It's especially nice if you're just a passenger. You just relax. It's called enjoying the in-between moments of life. So often. Thank you. So often that we're called. Why not be a poser? You can any time you like. And when you, where am I going with this? Okay. Sorry? Passenger, yeah. You've left the destination, you haven't arrived at where you go? No, you've left where you've been, you haven't arrived at the destination, you're in between. So much of your life is in between. And I love those in-between moments. Because there I can really relax. I know when I get to the destination I've got to talk, entertain people, or tell jokes or whatever. But actually when you're in between, that's when you can really relax and enjoy the moment. So I always grab the in-between moments of life, rather than worrying about I'm not going to get there on time. Whose time anyway? So, that is where we're not so tense with whatever we have to do. We know how to relax to the max. And then, when you get to your meditation practice, to learn how to relax. When I relax my body at the start of my meditation practice, really sweeping through the body, relaxing everything. It means that when I've completed a body sweeping, it's a preliminary to the meditation, my body feels so at ease that it's actually delightful. It's actually pleasurable to feeling a delightful body fully relaxed. It's one of the reasons why people go to like a spa to have a massage. It's why people go and have a hot bath after a busy day to relax all the muscles in your body. It's why people go to resorts to actually to lay in the sun on recliners with nothing to do in the whole world. It's why people come to the Buddhist society here to relax in meditation, where you can get the same results without paying so much money. You learn just how to relax your whole body, and it feels delightful. Which is one of the reasons why that I give a nickname to this place. What's the nickname? Club Med. Is it Belgravia or Pimlico?
Southern Belgravia.
Club Med, Southern Belgravia. Yeah. That's what Club Med. You go to Club Med to relax. You have to go such a long way and it's very expensive. Here, it's real cheap, cut price, very good value for money. And you can really relax your body. And then, once you learn how to relax your body, the next thing is relax your mind. Because once you've done your body relaxation, you feel really, really good. You know the next thing is your mind, that you learn how to relax as well. Simple meditation. So, I always like to invent, see things in a new way, just cut new ground. Did anyone ever watch Star Trek? Yeah. You know the opening there, where it says, to boldly go where no monk has gone before. That says boldly, doesn't it?
Yeah, but not monk.
Yeah, but that's what I say.
Split infinitive.
Split infinitive. I like splitting infinitive. I can split anything. To boldly go. Let's say boldly go. Where no man has gone before. Oh, it's to say, boldly go where no monastic has been before, monks and nuns. So sometimes it's nice to actually to break new ground, to innovate, to keep this amazing teaching alive. So, you got to, when you start your meditation, your body's relaxed. How do you relax your mind? Very difficult. You say, relax, relax, relax. How many times I tell you, relax, or else. So one thing which I do, there is in your car, there is something called the speedometer. In your house, you've got thermometer. In your mind, you've got the peaceometer. How peaceful are you? How relaxed? Right now. So you look at this peaceometer. You get to know what I'm talking about. If you don't know what I'm talking about, just right now, from 1 to 10, 1 is really peaceful, 10 is really agitated. Give it a number, from 1 to 10. How peaceful, how agitated are you? Don't tell me, just tell yourself. Now how can you reduce that number to get closer and closer to 1? Really peaceful. What makes you agitated? That piezometer reading go up, so 7, 8, 9? Even 10? What is the cause of peace in your own mind? And what makes it excited, disturbed? For those of you who have done a lot of study of Buddhism, that is right clear third Satipatthana, being aware of your mind and what causes it to be still, what causes it to be disturbed. So, but putting it in a very simple way, what's the cause of peace? Struggling and striving just makes you disturbed. Relax your mind. Think of it as that string. It's really taut, that's not relaxed. Somebody bangs the door, or they cough, bing, and it really disturbs you. When you're so relaxed, oh, they can bang the door, and by the time the sound of the door bang is over, you've already forgotten it. It's one of the problems with teaching meditation, because I gave a presentation at a hospital in Singapore. It was part of a seminar on Alzheimer's and dementia. And the doctor, the professor, was speaking first. There was a professor who started by saying, the signs of dementia are that you forget the past, you can't really think of the future, and you're socially disengaged. And I thought, uh-oh, that's me. And I've been teaching that to people for a long time. Let go of the past, let go of the future, and just be in solitude. I love solitude. But since coming to London, I've seen there's many people here in London that don't practice solitude. They practice what I call sorry-tude. You know, I bump into someone, and they say sorry. They've done nothing. It's not your fault, but you're still the one who says sorry. So we're a terrible race of people who keep saying sorry for something you've never done. Doesn't make any sense to me. That's called sorry-tude. Solitude is something better. And also, I also like silly-tude as well. Silly-tude, being a bit silly sometimes. A bit of fun in life. So anyway, so when we have a peaceful mind, which is not stretched by what you want in the future, or what's dragging you in the past, letting go, you find then the mind is really peaceful. You can feel that the number goes down, 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 down. You relax to the max first. And then, if you want to do something like a breath meditation, then you do the breath meditation. Once you've gained some peace in your mind. And once you've gained some peace in your mind, it's very easy to watch the breath. For hours. Why? Because you're relaxed and peaceful enough. That is where the awareness of the breath can be established. If anyone doubts me, I don't just tell jokes. I know my Pali, I know my suttas. It's called like establishing sati parimukham, which means has a priority, not in front of your nose. It never mean that. Giving it priority, the mindfulness and the calmness, get that in place first. And then you can go to things like the breath and it becomes very easy. You've prepared your body and mind to be able to watch the breath. And you get deep very quickly. And also, afterwards, are you really, really benefiting from the meditation? I just taught two retreats, not only short retreats, but afterwards they say, how do I know it's working? I said, ask the people you live with when you go home. If you're more a pain in the butt than when you left, that's not meditation. But if you're far more peaceful, easier to live with, more productive in the office after you've done a meditation retreat, that is success in meditation. So often, I've been teaching meditation and on my Tuesday night group that sometimes a woman comes and says, I never wanted to come this evening. I was tired, came home from work. But my kid, 6-year-old, said, Mummy, Are you going to meditation tonight? No, darling, I feel too tired. Mummy, you must go to meditation tonight. But I don't feel like it. Mummy, go to meditation tonight. Why, darling? Because you're a much nicer mummy once you come back from meditation. It has an effect on you. And even in business. What's his name? I've mentioned him earlier. Brian Josephson. Cambridge University. The only any Welsh people here from Wales? No. Crikey. No Welshman here. Oh, Welshman. One eighth, okay. That'll do for tonight. There's only one Welshman who's won the Nobel Prize for Physics, and that's Brian Josephson. And he won that Nobel Prize for quantum tunneling. You don't have to know what it means, but it was the basis of the Josephson junction, which allowed supercomputing. And he got that insight after he was meditating. Really still. This gives you innovation. Relaxing, innovate, succeed. That is how we relax to the max. Have a wonderful life. So, I think I've talked enough as usual. I did mention earlier that people like me have to start attending a special society, a therapy group. Not Alcoholics Anonymous, but for people who talk too much. Anonymous. That's my new society I'm going to be. So, now I think opportunity for questions. Is that good, Desmond?
Yeah.
Excellent. So, now questions, comments, or complaints on what I've said about relaxing. Relax. It's not as if you relax and you don't achieve anything, don't succeed. Your output, productivity, actually goes up. Yes. So using the breath first as a way to relax the mind rather than relaxing first. Teaching meditation for such a long time, some people find it difficult to watch the breath. And if they do watch the breath, they can only watch the breath for maybe two or three breaths, and that's with a lot of effort. Or the mind wanders away. Why does it do that? It is because you're not relaxed enough. All the problems and worries you're carrying around with you, all the concerns even about your bodily health, that you're just too tense to watch the breath. So if you learn how to relax, first of all, simple relaxation techniques. Number one, it gives you a really healthy body and can give you a great deal of insights how to deal with sicknesses and pain, like I mentioned a couple of examples. It also teaches you that you do need to calm the mind down and make it peaceful before you even start watching the breath. Just a little thing, actually it's a big thing, that for the last few years, trying to sort of make a new translation of the basic teachings from the Pali Canon, and in so doing, re-translating some of these terms which are way past their use-by date. Things like concentration for samadhi. It's stillness, not concentration. And if you use the word stillness, it's a totally different ball game on what we're trying to get when we meditate. Be still, not concentrated. If this was a concentration exercise, this place would be a concentration camp. Yeah. With all the negativity and bad memories that gives you. It's stillness. And before the what they called right effort, I call it right restraint, right stopping. Not a trying to do something, but a stopping, restraining, calming, pacifying. And that is what we do to begin, before we even do mindfulness of the breathing. We have to calm things down, first of all. Again, this is for those experts in every one of the four satipatthanas, the four focuses of mindfulness. We have to start, it's a prerequisite, vinaya loke abhijja dhammanasa, which is usually translated very inaccurately as having abandoned grief and covetousness for the world, which means nothing. The commentaries, and there's good ground for this in all of the suttas, basically it means having restrained the five hindrances. That is the instruction from the Buddha before you even start doing the satipatthana. And one of those satipatthanas, practices, is mindfulness of the breathing. So you have to restrain, limit, calm the five hindrances before you even start doing the breath meditation. And then the breath meditation is done at the right time. Not too fast, when you're not ready for this, first of all. Because my brother, he's getting old now, but he's 70 about 3 weeks ago. That just in his old age, he decided to take up playing the piano. And if you start learning how to play the piano, you can't start, playing Tchaikovsky's piano concerto. You've got to start with green sleeves or chopsticks or something. So let's start watching the breath. Let's start calming the mind, first of all. Relaxing the body, and then you go to the breath, and it's easy. Because sometimes I'm a bit frustrated that too many people start meditation and they say, I can't do it, I can't watch the breath. And they give up. And they lose this wonderful opportunity. No matter what race, religion, gender, or whatever they are, they lose a marvelous opportunity to really get into this practice, which was described by the Buddha, because they go too fast. You've got to go into the relaxation, first of all. That's why. Relax to the max. Even Ajahn Gunhai, he didn't say relax to the max because he wasn't English. In Thai, it was breathe in, breathe out, sabha. Really relaxing, not just little relaxing, but really getting into it. Really making whatever you're doing really peaceful. And thank you for that question, because that is really important. People go to the breath way too soon. And the only way they can keep attention on it is by holding it, by force, and they get frustrated. The breath wanders off, or the mind wanders off from the breath. You bring it back. It wanders off, you bring it back. It wanders off, bring it back. It wanders off, bring it back. It wanders off, bring it back. I think we're doing that for about 3 or 4 years. Until you thought, hey, hang on, something's wrong here. Why doesn't it stay? Then it stays. Okay, next question. Is that okay? Okay. Next question, comment or complaint?
How important is repetition?
How important is repetition? Actually, I've told many jokes many times, and I'm sure you've heard them many times as well. but every time you hear them, hear a story, or hear that teaching, you always get something more out of it. You always actually get some more juice out of every time you repeat something. So much so that over in one of the roughest parts of London, there's a pub. It's run by a Hells Angels, boxers, really rough pub. And the bartender there, actually the owner, has a standing challenge. Once he's squeezed a lemon into some cocktail or whatever, once he's squeezed a lemon, if anybody else can squeeze even one drop out of that lemon, free drinks for the night. I know it's not a good Buddhist simile, but, you know, it's the best you can do. And this is a really big guy, you know, Hell's Angels leader, really tough. So when he squeezes the lemon, he pulverizes it. So this little guy comes into the bar, you know, wearing a suit and a tie, really thin and scrawny. And he says, I want to have a try at the challenge. And the bartender laughs at him. Oh, come on, look, you're so weak. These big guys, professional wrestlers, they've tried it, they can't. I want to have a go, said this guy. Okay. So the bartender gets a lemon, cuts it in half, and squeezes it, and squeezes it, and squeezes it, and all the juice comes out. Here, have a try, he says to this little guy in the suit. And this little guy in the suit takes that, squeezes it, one drop, two drops, three drops come out, and the people in the bar can't believe it. Who are you? Where do you work? He said, I work for Inland Revenue. I'm the tax inspector. So you can always get a bit more out of my jokes and say my stories. So anyway, repetition, sometimes it does let you learn more. And repetition of, I don't know, even watching the breath go into it, or relax to the max. A little exercise for you. If you want, you can close your eyes or you can keep them open. Peace. 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 Okay, you can open your eyes now. When I say that word, with a pause, after you say that word, automatically the mind goes towards it. And then it hasn't got enough strength yet, so you repeat the word. And you can feel more peace. And you repeat it again. Every time you repeat it, you're actually directing your mind to what the word peace means for you. Its meaning, its essence, what peace is. So sometimes you can say these words to yourself repeatedly and you find that what it's signifying, what it means for you, gets reinforced in your mind. And it has a very powerful effect upon you. So that's why sometimes that repetition, every time you say something, you're actually directing your mind to look in that direction. So repetition can be very powerful as a means for arousing this quality which the words describe. And it becomes sometimes good fun. Any other questions? Is that what you meant with repetition?
Yes. Okay. Mindfulness.
Mindfulness. Sometimes I call it brainfulness. Because people think about it, but they don't really know it. Brainfulness. The mindfulness, yeah, I am actually pretty. That's a pretty brilliant translation. It was Rhys Davids did that, as far as I know. brilliant translation. Of course, it's overused and separated from the rest of these teachings, at least trying to be mindful, at least make it kindfulness, adding that kindness unto mindfulness. So it's not just something cold, because sometimes it's mindfulness for Marines going to war, so you know how to shoot straight and kill people. If it's kindfulness, that kindness together with mindfulness, it's far more powerful. So that's only just my take on it. Mindfulness is fine, but kindfulness is better. Is that what you meant, Desmond? Sort of? Yeah.
Yeah, but it also takes it away a bit from just awareness. Like
oh, yeah. Mm. Indeed, yeah, that's the brainfulness. Mm. Does your mind live up there? Mm. This was, you reminded me, I don't know who reminded me of this. Actually, it was Mangala this afternoon. My driver this afternoon. He was asking whether it was one of my brother's children. And of course, I went to visit them this afternoon. And you know what my nephew and niece calls me? An uncle who's a monk becomes a monkle. And even actually my grandnephew, you know, that's, he said, oh, it's Munkle. He's only about 4 years of age. And what do they call Venerable Chanda? Nunty. Like auntie with a nun in front of it. It's nice when people sort of invent these words. We extend the English language. So I haven't seen that in the Oxford English Dictionary yet. A monk, monk's proper address by his nephew and niece, Munkle. Maybe actually one day I'll get in there. So, but awareness and mindfulness.
And where does the mind live?
Oh yeah, where does the mind live? Yeah. Thank you so much. I was very unmindful there. So, this was actually my friend from, one of my friends from Cambridge. And his 5-year-old daughter was asked by the teacher in the class, what is the biggest thing in the world? This is a great example of insight, where insight is not seeing things in the same old way that you've always seen it before, but seeing it from another angle, understanding things from a different perspective. So, what is the biggest thing in the world? 5-year-old. My daddy. Because for a little child, daddy is really big. Elephant. They've just been to the zoo. A mountain. Much bigger than elephants. Now, they're getting somewhere. But the daughter of my friend put her hand up and said, my eye is the biggest thing in the world. This was brilliant. What do you mean your eye is the biggest thing in the world? Well, Miss, saying to the teacher, my eye can see her father, can see an elephant and a mountain and so much more. If all of that can fit into my eye must be pretty big. So she said, the biggest thing in the world is my eye, because everything you can see can fit into it. And that's actually what we call genius. Seeing things in a way that no one else sees. And it was so impressive that my friend, I was still in Thailand at this time, wrote in a letter about that story. But then, of course, you always extend these stories. Yes, the eye is pretty big, but your mind can see everything your eye can see and so much more which you can imagine. It can hear real and imaginary sounds, it can smell, it can taste, it can feel real and imaginary feelings like phantom limbs or whatever, and it can always know as well. In fact, everything you can ever experience through any of the senses can fit into your mind. which means the mind is the biggest thing. I never said in the world, because the world can fit into your mind. It's a different perspective. And I don't know if there's any physicists here, but that's pretty okay with modern physics. And how, before you even experience things, as we know it, you have to have a mind basically to collapse the Schrodinger equation. You understand what that means? But it's pretty sort of solid science, the mind being the biggest thing in the world. Sorry, the biggest thing, because the world can exist in the mind. And if once this universe stops, because this universe is in the mind, the universe doesn't stop. So the mind doesn't stop. It's the universe. The three realms, Kamaloka, Rupaloka, Arupaloka. Kamaloka can come and go. Rupaloka comes and goes too. But it's much more stable than Rupaloka. Before the world began was the mind. Anyway, that's all fascinating stuff. But nothing to do with relax to the max. But fascinating. Yes?
I've been watching your lecture for the last year. And you're always saying meditation and mindfulness is such a great stuff and very relaxed, you know, for the mind and for the body. And nowadays everyone's saying, you know, you take this tablet, you know, what the side effects, you know. And actually I came here to ask you face to face, what are the side effects for the body to practicing meditation?
Okay.
From the physical point, I guess you have a back problem because you see. But from the other side effect, can you experience your instead of saying always positive, maybe you can find from your practice any kind of other way
to see. No, the probably one side effect, if you do meditation a lot and you really get into it, is you do tend to lose your hair.
I love my hair.
It's a side effect. You have to give it up when you really want to get deep in renunciation.
People let me know.
There's hardly any side effects. You know, any bad side effects, that is. Because this is in the gradual training. This is the second sutra in the Digha Nikaya, the Samanyapala Sutta, where the new king goes to see the Buddha and says, what on earth are you doing? You could be enjoying wealth and comfort. What are you a monk for? Said to the Buddha. And the Buddha said, for happiness. Get much more happiness than you do as a king, and started to mention all the different forms of happiness, you know, in the spiritual life. Little things like having a meaning, which a lot of times people in this modern world, they go to work, but their meaning in life, what are you doing this for? Acquisition of money, if you manage to get late to the end, you get enough to live. Why do people always want more? Or is it the family? You know, having sort of kids and a beautiful, loving family. Is that it? And more we still look for more and more happiness. And then you come across, you know, these some of the monks and the nuns, and they're really legitimately happy. And really smart. I never, you know, I was hanging around with Nobel laureates in Cambridge, and then you go and see an Ajahn Chah, who's much smarter than all of them. And why? That just really rocked me. It says, how come this monk is only just grade 4 at school? I was just so much more balanced and smart than I would ever be. And why? Because that beautiful kindness, even the being a good person, brings up the natural happiness, being kind, being generous. There's a generosity, it's a beautiful form of happiness. Not here, but I remember one talk as a layperson. There was this Tibetan nun, this is maybe 50 years ago now, gave a talk, and I was, oh, it couldn't be that long, maybe 48 years. Gave a talk, and it just all she was doing was being compassionate, being kind. Just serving in an orphanage somewhere in Sikkim somewhere. And then I was so impressed, I went to my bank and took £20 out of my bank, just on a whim, because I was a poor student. You know, my father had already died, my mother was just struggling to survive, and that was 2 weeks' food money. And I still had food to eat, I never starved, but I went hungry. And I did that, and I was just, to this day it causes me so much happiness. The best £20 I'd ever spent. Because I keep remembering every time. A little bit of sacrifice, seeing, imagining little kids having food to eat or a dry place to stay. Little things like that, goodness, kindness, generosity, renunciation. It's not what you want or what's for you, it's for others. You get so much happiness and joy. So the happiness and joy when you start meditating, it's all about letting go, renouncing, is enormous. It gives you meaning. And that's something in a meaningless world where sometimes we get frustrated, disappointed, disillusioned. It's wonderful to see that meaning and to live it. That's one of the great advantages of meditation. Finding meaning. Okay, so, and another question? Yeah, go on. Yes, it's very easy, very simple solution is to get some sort of meditation room and just every executive lock them in there for half an hour every lunch hour. Don't let them out. I heard this story. There was this gentleman over in New York, he was a criminal lawyer, and he represented people who were accused of things like murder, which carried the death penalty. So it was a high-stress job. If he made a mistake, it would be an electric chair. And so that was really sort of life and death stress. And his, together with his secretary, they found a cupboard in the office, took all of the papers out, put a cushion in there, and she locks him in there half an hour every lunch hour. He puts him in there and locks the key. They can't come out. If anybody calls or emails, I'm sorry, he's in his cupboard. And she does that because it's far less a pain in the butt for her in the afternoon, and it's much more efficient. Sometimes you can just see to see angles which can get his client off the death penalty. Or whatever it is. When you are stressed, you've been working all morning, and you don't take a break at lunch, what happens? You just push yourself and you get very negative, very angry, frustrated too, and your performance level goes down. You've seen that in yourself. I've seen that. If I'm writing an email and I'm tired, it takes me half an hour to write. I just push it aside and do some meditation, relax, or even take a nap. Afterwards, it's so easy. You can write all the answers very quickly. Because your brain has time to re-energize. So this is the the simile, I've said it here I think a couple of times, how heavy is a glass of water? The longer I hold it, the heavier it feels. After 1 minute, I'm tired. After 2 minutes, I'm aching. After 3 minutes, I'm in pain and a very dumb monk. When this gets too heavy to hold comfortably, you put it down and rest. Only rest for a short while, and then after that while, you pick it up, it's actually lighter. It's easier to handle. It's the same weight, but because you've rested, it's easier to handle. That's called stress management. But do we know how to put it down? No. We keep carrying it, pushing it. We've got no time to put it down. We've got a deadline. We've got a schedule to fulfill. That's what kills us. Instead, when you're tired, put it down. Put it down for half an hour, and the next 3 hours you get in the next 2 hours you get 3 hours work done. It's called, and this has gone to Harvard Business School, it's called an investment of time. You're making time by taking a rest. Simple Buddhist mindfulness, kindness, and wisdom too. We know how to put it down. We're not afraid of rest because we know we need it. It makes best for the company, best for your family, best for productivity, best for your mental health. That's what we do. Not just mental health in corporations, it's mental health in schools. So that kids can learn how to rest their mind. And then they can work. That's why in schools in the old days, we used to have a break in the morning, break in the afternoon. And only one of the times when England had its empire, Britain had its empire. What was the reason why British had an empire which ruled the world and now has got hardly anything left? Why? It's because they used to have tea break in the morning and tea break in the afternoon. And that was not negotiable. You have to have your tea break in the morning and the afternoon. So all the civil servants, all the leaders, whatever, they'd always have the tea break. So they'd relax in the morning. Relax in the afternoon. As soon as they abandoned tea breaks, lost control of the world. That's my theory. I don't know if you actually subscribe to that, but you know, there's a little bit of truth in it. When we know how to relax. To the max. How are we doing for time? Okay, yeah. Okay.
Where are you going tomorrow?
We're going tomorrow to Malaysia.
To Malaysia.
Sorry? Yeah. No peace for the wicked. That's my motto. Always on the run. That's why I said I can say anything this evening, because I'll be out of the country by tomorrow.
Oh, Ajahn, it's Halloween. Can't you tell a ghost story?
Oh, yeah.
Halloween, ghost story. Okay. Okay, can you sit down again a bit? Hey.
No, sure.
No, this has to be the person went to the talk at a Buddhist society one evening, and on the way home, there was two ways to go home. One was a long way, one was a short way, short route. The short route was through the cemetery. But they didn't believe in ghosts. They were rational scientists, no such thing as ghosts. So they took the short path through the cemetery. And of course, in the cemetery, the lighting is much, much dimmer than on the main roads. So they're walking through the cemetery, halfway through, nothing had happened, you know, ghost stuff is all hocus pocus. But when they pass the halfway mark, have you ever had a feeling you're being followed? That's what he had. Yeah, the summit was following him. And so his senses started to listen behind him. And sure enough, he could hear something behind him going, bump, bump, bump. He thought, no, imagination. He carried on walking, listened even more carefully, bump, 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 something was following him. And he made his biggest mistake. He turned around to take a look. And what he saw broke him out into a sweat born of terror. What he saw was a coffin, vertical, still with the soil dripping off it, bumping behind him. Bump, bump, he's being chased by a coffin emerged from the cemetery. Oh, he really sort of lost it. He ran as fast as he could. No mindfulness or awareness. He just was running. And as he ran, he got to the cemetery gates, went outside. The coffin was catching up. So he ran as fast as he could. Fortunately, his house was just, you know, maybe 100 foot down the road, 100 meters or whatever. And he managed to get to his garden gate, and the coffin was really almost catching up behind him. He didn't open the garden gate, he jumped over it. And so, as he jumped over it, the coffin got to the garden gate. The coffin couldn't jump that high. He thought he was safe. Bump! 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 Against the garden gate until the hinges lost their connection to the wall and the garden gate fell off. It was coming towards him down the path. He reached for his keys. What happened? He dropped them. Oh, and the coffin was coming after him. Bump, bump, bump. He managed to pick up any old key, put it in, it was the right key, so lucky. The right key, put it in the lock, opened the door, jumped inside, and slammed the door just as the coffin came to the door. He could see it through the glass in the front door. He was sweating, perspiring, his heart was pounding. He was home, though. He was safe. Bump! As the coffin started hitting the front door. Bump! As the hinges started to give way. Bump! As the wood started to splinter on the door. He ran up the stairs to the upstairs, and as he got to the top of the stairs, bump! As the coffin broke down the front door of his house. He was in big trouble now. At the top of the stairs, he thought, maybe coffin can't climb stairs. But to his horror, bump, 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 the coffin started to climb up the stairs. So he went into the room, which was the bathroom, which had a lock. He locked the door of the bathroom, turned engaged. And he could hear the coffin come up the stairs. Bump! Onto the toilet door. Bump! As the door started to give way. Bump! As the coffin broke down the door. There was no place left to run. No escape. He was facing the coffin only a few feet away. And just instinctively, he reached for something on the shelf as the coffin approached. He threw it at the coffin. The bottle broke and this brown liquid spread over the coffin. And the coffin never moved again. He wondered what it was and he looked. It was cough mixture. Oh. It stops the coffin! That's for Halloween. Thank you for listening.